Hello, this is Hugh LaFollette, your host for Ideas and Issues. My guest today is Mark Bauerlein, professor of English at Emory University, and we're discussing Louis Menand's The Metaphysical Club, A Story of Ideas in America. Mark, glad to have you on the show.
Oh, glad to be here.
Could you begin by giving the listener a brief overview of this book before we begin to discuss the details?
Sure. Menand's book is a narrative history of the leading intellectuals in American life in the late 19th century. He's drawn to them in part because the four main figures, Oliver Wendell Holmes, Charles Sanders Peirce, William James, and John Dewey, are really the originators of the only homegrown philosophy in the history of the United States, that being pragmatism. And what Menand seeks to do is to explain this philosophy and how each of these thinkers developed their work by putting them into the context of each thinker's life and to draw out of their experiences the principles and beliefs that eventually found their way into the books and articles that these thinkers read. So this is really the innovative thrust of Menand's books, to try to put these beliefs and ideas into the personal situation and the personal experience of the thinkers. And along the way, one must say that he does tell these stories, get into the personal histories in an engaging and interesting fashion. And for most people who've read the book, they find it a real page-turner. He does bring these figures to life. And one can see that in part by the huge public response to the book last year.
Well, you've already partially answered this question, but maybe you have a bit more to say. What do you see as the strengths of this book?
The strength of the book, I think, is to put a lot of abstract ideas, abstract principles of pragmatism. You take an abstract principle such as the meaning of an idea is contained in the consequences of its use. Now, something like that sounds very abstract. It sounds rarefied and disconnected from experience, from our ordinary day-to-day lives. What Menand tries to do is to discover situations and events in these thinkers' lives that would have led them to embrace an idea of the consequences of an idea being really the meaning of the idea. And he does this by going back to moments in their life, such as when Oliver Wendell Holmes was a young man serving in the Civil War and was grievously wounded in one of the earliest battles of the war. And as Holmes was lying in a hospital on a cot that night after being wounded in terrible pain, Menand believes that he reflected upon the ways in which ideas about human nature, about slavery, and other notions led to the Civil War, led to violence, led to people lying on cots, dying, and of gunshot wounds. And so the strength of it, and where Menand obviously concentrated, was in trying to relocate and situate ideas out of the academic books, out of the refined formulae, and back into concrete moments in these figures' lives. And that I think, is the strength of the book, and why, as a method, that's the strength of the book, and that explains why I think readers were so drawn to it. The idea of bringing ideas into concrete moments was an engaging one for many readers.
Would it be fair to say that by looking at these ideas, that would actually serve two different functions for him? One is to help explain what these abstract and rarefied ideas meant in a way that the average reader might understand, but also that he thinks that these experiences help explain how these particular individuals came to have the ideas that they in fact had.
Yes, I would say both the things you said are true. By putting ideas back into personal experience, we can understand them a little better. We can see their genesis in concrete ways. That is one thing. Another thing is at the root of this method is a belief Manand has, and it's a belief associated with a group of thinkers and writers of the last 20 years who are called the neo-pragmatists, and their main leading figure is a philosopher named Richard Rorty. And Rorty's principle is that ideas are not abstract entities that we formulate in our reflective, disinterested moments. Instead, ideas are instruments. They are entities through which we can do certain things, through which we can cope with certain things. And we form these instruments out of moments of difficulty, moments when we have a problem, when we can't understand something, when we're suffering some kind of confusion and dismay. We need an intellectual instrument that will help us cope with it. And this, for Rorty and the neo-pragmatists, and including Manand, is really where ideas come from. And this is how they should be understood. For Rorty and other neo-pragmatists, the problem is when we start treating ideas as separate from concrete human affairs. We look at them almost as algebraic equations, which are divorced from concrete realities. And so what the neo-pragmatists are always trying to do is to sort of reverse that process and bring ideas back down into experiential moments. And so they asked, how do we examine this idea? Not by an abstract analysis of it, but instead by looking at the experiences, the kinds of difficulties, the human problems that this idea addresses. How does this idea help us get through life? This is their fundamental question. And this is why Manand ultimately wishes to narrate ideas through the lives of these figures. That's why he calls it, in the subtitle, a story of ideas in America. It's not an analysis of ideas. It is a story of ideas.
Okay, late in the show, I'd like to come back and talk about that claim a bit more. But let me just ask you one more general question, though you certainly hinted at it already. What do you see as the main weaknesses or drawbacks of this book?
Well, the weakness is related to the strength, because in trying to bring ideas down to concrete human moments, we get the advantage of giving ideas flesh and blood, and that's good. But there is a danger in that in making ideas into instruments related to life, we impoverish their possibilities. You know, at one point, Manand says ideas are metaphysically no different from forks. And what he's doing is, it's a polemical metaphor that he's creating in order to say, forks help us to eat. This is what a fork is for. Ideas help us in the same way. Okay, they're both just instruments. Well, that's fine in terms of making that point. But if you look at this comparison, you know, a little bit further, you know, beyond the epigrammatic form of it, you begin to say, you know, if ideas are instruments, to compare them to forks is to cover over so many vast differences between the idea kind of instrument and the kind of silverware kind of instrument. Because if ideas are instruments, they can do many, many things. They can inspire us, they can depress us, an idea can help shake up a political system. An idea can suddenly bring about an illumination. It can produce out of confusion clarity. And this is something extremely powerful and diverse, and it can happen in many, many different ways. So the problem when we try to ground ideas in personal experience is that we take away so many other possibilities of what ideas can do. And so this I think is the danger, and in such an approach, and why I think sometimes that at moments in Menand's book, when he stops telling stories and begins discussing ideas, he really verges on anti-intellectualism. Okay, he doesn't want people to consider ideas in any other way except as simple instruments, like utensils.
All right, let me ask then, I want to make sure I'm right about the source of your objection, mm-hmm. that you're not necessarily opposed to the claim that ideas are like forks in some ways. The problem is that the analogy is taken as being exhaustive, then it suggests that ideas are just like forks in every respect.
Right, right.
And the problem is forks have they are useful tools, but they're uses are fairly limited, fairly confined, whereas the usefulness of ideas is much broader.
Right. I mean, if you take something like a fork, it can only do one thing. You know, we can stab a piece of food and put it in our mouth. Well, yes, an idea is like that in a certain way, but it's so simplifying. Okay, there is one tiny little truth in that. But how do you compare a fork to an idea of natural rights? Rousseau and other Enlightenment figures came up with an idea of natural rights. And look at what that idea did. It inspired people. It made them write books. It helped to topple monarchy in some areas. How can you then come back and say, natural rights, that was an instrument. Yes, in a certain way, that was an instrument. And it had political uses. But it was much more than that. It had emotional uses. It had psychological uses. It helped provide dignity to people of different classes. Do you really want to compare something like that to a fork?
Okay, no one's ever written Ode to a Fork, at least as far as I know, or no one's ever put a political campaign based on forks.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
So the problem is not necessarily the use of these metaphors. The problem is portraying them as if they exhausted what ideas were.
Right, right. I mean, they have a glib appeal. I mean, one thing about a metaphor, one thing about a good metaphor, they are memorable. If you go up and give a speech, if you give a one-hour speech, and you talk about if you talk about ideas, if you talk about politics, you can talk about 10 different issues, and you have one metaphor, chances are the audience will remember the metaphor. Okay, it's the kind of thing that sticks. So rhetorically, it is it's an effective instrument, but again, it can be a misleading and simplifying one too.
Okay, I want to continue along this vein in the second half of the show. This is Ideas and Issues. My guest today is Mark Bauerlein, professor of English at Emory University, and we're discussing Louis Menand's The Metaphysical Club. I'm wondering if the same thing could be said about this idea of experience. As you explained it, part of what Menand tries to do is to ground these people's ideas in their experiences. And if I understand your objection, you think that looking at their experiences can help explain the idea. They may help explain, at least in part, how someone came to have the idea. The problem, as with the analogy of the fork, is you don't think it tells the whole story about the idea.
I think that most certainly examining the experiences, the life experiences of idea makers is a very useful and effective means of understanding the context within which certain ideas appeared. For example, Manan talks about William James as a student at Harvard and going down to South America on scientific expeditions. He was involved a lot in natural science as a student. And what he saw while he was there was the way in which different researchers would look at primitive societies, would look at South American nature in the jungle and along the Amazon River and such places, and how they would impose schemes of classification upon what he later called the blooming, buzzing confusion of reality. And he witnessed there how such classification schemes tended to impoverish life, and that bringing ideas too strongly to bear upon what you see and feel and sense could distort the real world. And that one can see out of this experience, James began to understand that we shouldn't insist too strongly on our classification schemes, that we shouldn't make our beliefs too rigid, that we should always accept that there is a kind of fringe, a haziness around all of our beliefs, that it shouldn't be closed off, that we should admit that there are certain mysterious or troubling or difficult aspects of experience that no outlook can entirely exhaust. Now, fair enough. I think one could say that we can see a genesis in James's thinking about these things from his experiences with scientists in South America. And it's a very effective way of articulating that idea. But you don't want to confuse things. You don't want to say that, therefore, James's idea was true. You know, you can't analyze the truth of an idea by someone saying, but that's what I experienced. You know, this speaks to what I felt and thought. Well, that isn't a justification for an idea, just because you believed it. That's one thing. Another thing, if James came back from South America with this idea, and then he didn't wish to found the idea on anything else, let's say on logical notions, if he didn't try and prove it in some other way, well, then one would say that we shouldn't trust the idea. I mean, this explanation for it may be illuminating, but it can't justify the idea. And I don't think James would have trusted that either. I mean, if the only point we're making is that certain experiences and opinions and attitudes go into the formation of ideas, nobody would object to that, right? But ideas can't be reduced to it. You know, an idea has a life of its own once it's conceived. Other people are going to do different things with it. Other people will seek to refute it, not on the grounds of your personal experience, but on the grounds, let's say, of its internal consistency, on the grounds of its morality, and so on. So the danger is turning ideas into, like, the result of personal experience, and there's a lot more to it than that.
And so, for example, one of the dangers of relying simply upon personal experiences is that one's experiences may be wholly out of the ordinary and therefore distort, if nothing else, the experiences of other individuals.
That's right. What happens if you only look at ideas this way, and you walk into, let's say you walk into a, you're on a jury in a legal case, and you've heard the case, and you walk into a room, and other people bring their ideas into the room, the other jury members, and you disagree about something, and it really comes down to one's personal experience and another's personal experience. What are you going to do? Well, you have to come up with a decision, don't you? I mean, people can't just say, I don't think that. I have lived differently. You know, I have a different background than you. Well, people say that all the time, but it doesn't lead to productive discussion. It doesn't lead to productive debate. You can't ground your ideas just on your personal experiences. We all have different personal experiences. If someone says, well, that's what I experienced, well, that changes the terms of the debate, because if I'm debating someone over this, I don't want to attack someone's personal experience. That's not up to me to do. So ideas in public settings, in public debate, they have to be separated from personal experiences, or they can't be debated. You know, they can't be criticized. They can't be revised.
And when you say have to be separated, you don't mean, again, that the experiences can't be part of the discussion. People can refer to them. It's just, again, that they don't tell the whole story. They're not the only way in which someone can try to explain and justify a belief.
Right. And they can't be the decisive factor in whether I should accept an idea or not.
I'd like to move to a slightly different way of framing these questions. It's clear that you've thought a great deal about pragmatism, that you're very familiar with pragmatism. And despite the fact that you think that Manand has done a service in many respects, that in other respects he's not done a service, that is, he's oversimplified these people's ideas. If you were going to write the book that Manand wrote, how would you do it differently? What would you, I mean, would you do some of the things that he's done or none of it? Would you supplement it in certain ways? What would you want to emphasize in trying to explain pragmatism to the ordinary reader?
Right. Well, one thing I would say is Manand has produced several compelling stories of pragmatism in action. For example, he talks about the trial of regarding a will and the signature on a will. And the question posed was, did someone forge a signature on a will by superimposing that signature above it and just copying it out, so producing an exact duplicate of a single signature on another document? Now, the question posed in the trial, whether this was a forgery or not, was, what are the odds that a perfect duplicate of a signature, that someone would sign a document perfectly the same way twice? So Peirce, Charles Sanders Peirce, and his father were called in to testify on the case. And they actually came up with a statistical analysis of the odds of someone signing a document exactly the same way twice. And the odds were astronomical. I mean, millions to one. And they actually testified, and they went through and explained how all this might have happened, how it might have come about that the signature would be duplicated. And they said, virtually impossible, but they did statistical analysis. They didn't just rely upon opinion. They took some statistical principles regarding handwriting and applied them to the question. No moral issue. They treated it solely as a scientific problem to be analyzed pragmatically. And that was a very effective set piece in the book. I believe it first appeared in The New Yorker, that showed pragmatism in action. And that one would wish to reproduce if one did this book. But the problem is when Manand turns to a general understanding of ideas, what we've been talking about here. He says at one point, human beings produce culture in the same way they produce yogurt. These are the kind of reductive, almost polemical statements and anti-intellectual statements, as I said, that I think could have been removed from the book with certainly no loss to its narrative momentum, and I think would have given a better representation of the pragmatists' ultimate beliefs. Because one thing they all agreed in was the power of ideas. They believed an idea can convert pain into pleasure. An idea can bring understanding of the past. It could lay out a future for you by which you could lead your life. Okay? Once you start talking about forks and yogurt, those things don't do that. And frankly, the early pragmatists would have been appalled at such comparisons. So it is really the shortchanging of the power of ideas that I certainly would have done differently. in writing the book.
In the last 3 minutes, I mean, we've talked about pragmatists, and you said that they are, you know, this most influential group of American thinkers. Certainly that's the premise upon which the book itself was written. For the listener who's not familiar, what would you say to them? How would you try to explain what pragmatism is to a person who's not yet read any of these figures?
Right, right. Well, I would send the person to William James's lectures on pragmatism, which were very clear and accessible, and still profound. And the real thrust of pragmatism is, I think, to consider ideas as instruments, as things that can change our minds. And I don't mean change our minds about an issue, change our outlook upon the world. And that this could have a therapeutic value. For example, if you are experiencing something and you don't understand what you're experiencing, the thing you're suffering is not only something outside, but you're suffering also an internal confusion. You don't understand. You know, if someone is having a hard time coming to terms with his or her own past, it's not only the past that bothers them, but also their inability to understand the past that bothers them. What pragmatism proposes to do is to develop ideas, or to show you ways of developing ideas that won't take the external pain away, but it can take the internal pain away by providing an idea that explains what is happening. It is something that can clarify, that can forge a new distinction, that can, again, help you assimilate something that you are suffering. And so what it does is it helps with internal confusions. It helps with mental disorientation. This is what pragmatism does. William James's example is a scientist who in the 19th century suddenly discovers radium and realizes there's something about radium that doesn't fit the old laws of science. I'm confused. I don't understand this. I can't explain this. Until the scientist comes up with an explanation for it, there is a dissatisfaction. There is a confusion. If you come up with an idea to explain it, the radium doesn't go away, but the radium can be assimilated to your experience. It can make sense at that point. Until you can find an idea to explain it, it doesn't make sense. And it makes you unhappy. So in a way, you could call pragmatism as a search for ideas that can make our lives happier, that can clear up our intellectual confusion.
And so there is a deep relation. About this, Menand is right. About this, the neo-pragmatists are right. There is a deep connection between ideas and experience. It's just that it's not the simple one that Menand describes in his book.
Right. And that ideas are powerful, mysterious things. This is one thing the pragmatists keep in mind. Ideas have a mystery surrounding them. This is the power of ideas. This is what gets lost too often in the neo-pragmatist discussion, but which the pragmatists, I think, had a firm understanding of.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for appearing in the show today.
Thank you.
I've been speaking today with Mark Bauerlein, professor of English at Emory University. We've been discussing Louis Menand's The Metaphysical Club. This is Hugh LaFollette for Ideas and Issues. Good day.